Chapter 2, the year 802,701.
This is the time traveller's narration.
I told you last Thursday of the principles of the time machine and showed you the actual thing itself, incomplete, in the workshop. There it is now. A little damaged, one of the ivory bars is cracked and a brass bar is bent, but the rest of it is all right. It was at 10 o'clock this morning when the first time machine began its journey. I checked everything for the last time and sat down on the seat. I was scared and excited at the same time. I took the starting lever in one hand and the stopping one in the other, pressed the first and almost immediately the second. I felt a terrible sensation of falling, and looking around, I saw the laboratory exactly as before. Had anything happened? For a moment, I suspected that my mind had tricked me. Then I noticed the clock. A moment before, it was 1 or 2 minutes past 10. Now, it was nearly 3:30. I drew a breath, gripped the starting lever with both hands, and pressed it heavily. The laboratory got hazy and went dark. Mrs. Watchett, the housekeeper, came in and walked towards the garden door without seeing me. I suppose it took her about 1/2 minute to cross the room, but to me she seemed to go across the room in 1 second, like a rocket. I pressed the lever to its extreme position. Nights and days followed one upon the other, incessantly and very rapidly. The laboratory became hazier and hazier. A low sound filled my ears, and a strange confusion descended on my mind. I'm afraid I can't explain the peculiar sensations of time travelling. They are very unpleasant. I had the impression that the laboratory had been destroyed. The succession of darkness and light was painful to the eye. Then I saw the moon turning quickly from new moon to full moon. As I went on, the sequence of night and day turned into one continuous greyness, and the sky became a wonderful deep blue. The sun changed into a line of fire, and the stars were not visible any longer. The landscape was hazy and indistinct. I was still on the hill on which this house now stands. I saw trees change, now brown, now green. They grew quickly and soon died. I saw huge buildings rise up and, soon after, fall down. The whole surface of the earth seemed to have changed. The little clock hands that registered my speed moved round faster and faster. My speed was over 1 year a minute. The unpleasant sensations of the start were not so bad now. They had turned into a kind of hysterical excitement. At first, I didn't think of stopping, but then a certain curiosity, and with it anxiety, took complete possession of me. I thought, how has man developed? What wonderful advances have been made? When I stop and look at the future world, what will I see? And so I decided it was time I stopped. Like an impatient fool, I pulled the handle forcefully, and immediately the machine turned over. I was thrown headlong through the air. I was senseless for a while, then I regained consciousness. Icy hail was falling all around me, and in a moment I was wet to the skin. "Fine hospitality," said I, "to a man who has travelled innumerable years to see you." I stood up and looked round me and saw a colossal figure. It was of white marble and looked like a winged sphinx. All around I also saw very big buildings. I asked myself, what has happened to man? Perhaps humanity has turned into an evil and cruel race with no pity. They might consider me a horrible animal to be killed. Suddenly I panicked, seized by fear. I turned frenetically to the time machine and tried hard to readjust it. At last it moved and turned over again, but in doing so, I cut my chin deeply. Then I heard voices coming from the White Sphinx. In the distance, I saw a group of figures dressed in rich, soft clothes. I could clearly see a man. He was a small creature, perhaps 4 feet tall, dressed in a purple tunic with a leather belt at the waist. Sandals were on his feet. His legs were bare to the knees. In a few seconds, this fragile thing was standing in front of me. He came up to me and laughed into my eyes. The absence of any sign of fear struck me at once. Then he turned to those who were following him and spoke to them in a strange and very sweet language. There were others coming, and very soon, a group of about 10 of these little creatures were around me. Their hair was curly and quite long, but there was no sign of hair on their faces. Their ears and mouths were unusually small. Their lips were bright red and thin, and their chins were pointed. Their eyes were large and gentle. One of them addressed me, but of course I couldn't understand a single word, so I shook my head and, pointing to my ears, shook it again. He came a step forward, hesitated, and then touched my hand. Then I felt other soft little fingers on my back and shoulders. They wanted to make sure I was real. There was nothing at all alarming in this. Indeed, there was something in these pretty little people that inspired confidence, a graceful gentleness, a certain childlike ease. And besides, they looked so frail that I could imagine myself knocking down the whole group easily. When I noticed they were touching the time machine, I immediately removed the little levers that would set it in motion and put them in my pocket. As they made no effort to communicate with me, but simply stood around me smiling and speaking in soft tones to each other, I began to think that those creatures were fools. Then one of them asked me a question that showed him to be on the intellectual level of one of our 5-year-old children. He asked me, in fact, if I had come from the sun in a thunderstorm. I was disappointed. And for a moment I thought that I had built the time machine in vain. I nodded. Then one came laughing towards me, carrying a chain of beautiful flowers, and put it around my neck. Everyone clapped their hands, and soon after, they all started running in all directions to pick up flowers. In a couple of minutes, I was covered with all sorts of flowers quite new to me. My general impression of the world I was seeing all around me was that of a beautiful but neglected garden. Then they led me past the Sphinx of white marble towards a large grey building of stone. As I went with them, I laughed, thinking of my great expectations of finding a highly advanced race of men. The big doorway opened into a great brown hall. There were about 100 people eating there. I saw a lot of tables made of stone, and on these there was plenty of fruit. I recognized some, apples, oranges, and others. They were just much bigger than the ones I knew, but for the most part, they were strange. The people who were leading me sat down and started to eat the fruit. They invited me to do the same, and I accepted willingly, because I felt thirsty and hungry. Their diet was only fruit. These people of the remote future were strict vegetarians. Indeed, I found afterwards that horses, cattle, sheep, dogs had all become extinct. As soon as I had satisfied my appetite, I decided to learn the language of these new people. The fruit seemed a good thing to begin with, and holding one up, I began a series of interrogative sounds and gestures. At last, A fair-haired little creature seemed to understand my intention and said a name. My first attempts to repeat the sounds of their language caused incredible amusement. I felt like a schoolmaster among children and went on. After a while, I managed to learn about 20 words, among which the verb to eat. But it was slow work, and the little people soon got tired and wanted to get away from my questions. So I decided to let them give me very short lessons when they wished. I realized they had no interest in anything and noticed that almost all those who had surrounded me at first had gone. I went out of the Great Hall and decided to climb up to the top of a hill from which I could get a wider view of our planet in the year 802,701 AD. That was the date the clock hands of my machine had shown before stopping. Looking round, I realized that there were no small houses to be seen. Single houses didn't exist any longer. Here and there among the vegetation there were palace-like buildings, but the house and the cottage, which form such characteristic features of our own English landscape, had disappeared. Then I looked at a small group of little figures that were following me joyfully. In a flash, I realized that all of them, males and females, had the same form of costume, the same hairless faces, and the same girlish bodies. These people of the future were all alike. All the differences which now mark off the sexes had disappeared, apart from the biological ones, and the children seemed to be the miniatures of their parents. I thought that the strength of a man and the tenderness of a woman, the institution of the family and the differentiation of occupations are necessities of an age of physical force. Where there is no danger of war, there is no necessity for an efficient family, and the specialization of the sexes disappears. That was what I thought at the time. Later, I discovered that reality was very different. While I was meditating on these things, my attention was attracted by a pretty little structure, like a well under a dome. Wells? They still exist, I wondered. Turning back, I saw that I was left alone. The little people couldn't walk as fast as I did and weren't following me anymore. With a strange sense of freedom and adventure, I increased my pace and reached the peak of the hill. There, I sat down and looked at the broad view of our old world under the sunset of that long day. It was the most beautiful view I have ever seen. The sun had already gone down. Below was the valley of the Thames. There were no separate fields, no signs of proprietary rights, no evidence of agriculture. The whole earth had become a garden. Communism, said I to myself. The sunset made me think of the sunset of mankind. Strength is the result of need. The constant work of improving the conditions of life, the true civilizing process that makes life more and more secure, had gone on and on until it reached its highest point. One triumph of a united humanity over nature had followed another. Things that are now dreams had become projects, and these projects had become realities. Great social improvements had been realized too. Mankind, wonderfully dressed, was housed in splendid buildings, and I had found them engaged in no work. There were no signs of struggle, neither social nor economical. The shop, the advertisement, traffic, all that commerce which constitutes the body of our world, was gone. It was natural on that golden evening that I was thinking of a social paradise. I thought of the small, weak bodies of the people, their lack of intelligence, and those big buildings in ruins, and it strengthened my belief in a perfect conquest of nature. In fact, after the battle comes quiet. Humanity had been strong, energetic, and intelligent, and had used all its vitality to change the conditions under which it lived. And then the reaction of the changed conditions came. Under the new conditions of perfect comfort and perfect safety, that energy which with us is strength became weakness. For many and many years, there had been no danger of war or violence, no danger from wild beasts, no diseases to require strength to fight them. For such a life, what we call the weak are as well equipped as the strong, as they are indeed no longer weak. This has always been the fate of energy insecurity. It is used in art and in love, and then decay comes with time. As I stood there in the dark, I thought that in this simple explanation, I had understood the whole secret of these lovely people. Perhaps they had devised a method for birth control, but their numbers had rather diminished than kept stationary. That would account for the many abandoned ruins. My explanation was very simple and believable enough, but it was wrong.